Today, we are welcoming Max Minsker of Bookmate. Max, thanks so much for being here.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
All right. So, Bookmate is at trybookmate.com. Is it .com or .co?
We got both.
You got both. Okay. So, trybookmate.com is the website. What is Bookmate?
Bookmate is a tax filing services or a tax filing service. We actually serve a lot of different demographics, but primarily small businesses, startups, and international founders of U.S. businesses as well. So what we do is, you know, we take care of everything end to end when it comes to filing your taxes, making sure you're compliant with the IRS and all that stuff, primarily for businesses. Like I said, that's what we do.
Okay. And so that is, would you call yourself like an online CPA firm?
Yeah, I think that's
what is the delineation between like kind of an old school, like you walk into some old guy's office and he's a CPA versus what you're doing? Like what are the differences for people?
You know, that's a really good question. And it's one that I've kind of thought a lot about over the years, right? Because it's like, what about our business is possible that wasn't possible before? And I think that the distinction is that when you go to a local CPA office, the way it started, right? Like, let's say even before the internet, the CPA would serve the people in the local community. So maybe you have some high income earner that lives down the street, right? Or you have a business, like somebody owns a bakery, somebody owns an insurance agency, right? And you kind of serve all of these different people. And what they have in common is they, you know, maybe have an income or they own a small business or a stake in a business in your community, right? So that's like your demographic, right, of who you serve. But what we can do, because we're serving people online, right? You call it an online CPA firm, is we can target a specific type of customer and say, hey, are you a tech startup? Are you an international founder of a US company? Are you an SMB that does business mostly online, right? We can kind of pick the types of people that we want to serve, and whether they're in San Francisco or in New York City or in Texas or across the world, or maybe they're in Canada or in Europe or wherever they are, right? We can kind of say, hey, we serve this one type of business. If this is you, it doesn't matter what your geography is, we can serve you. So that's what I think is a little different. And I think the other thing is, because we use Zoom and it's all done online, right? It's a little bit more automated and it's a little bit more of a purely digital experience. So I think that the customer segmentation for a firm that's specifically online is a lot different. And then how you serve that customer is then a lot different, right? Because you're not talking to them face-to-face as in person or collecting physical paper documents from them. You're doing it over the internet. So the specialty and the modes of communication, I think, and the modes of service are a little bit different.
Yeah. And so we actually, so my company Better Legal used Bookmate for the first time this year. You know, we talked about this for, we talked about, you know, switching a couple of months ago, and I was just kind of going through our old, I wasn't necessarily happy with our CPA, but I didn't really know any different. It was kind of, it was someone's guy that they used, and he kind of helped us from inception. But his prices just kept going up, wasn't providing any better service. He actually was, I think, providing worse service. I just found out that they were doing our Delaware state compliance for a while, and then they just stopped doing it, but didn't tell us that they weren't doing it. They just, in the invoice, showed us what they did do and didn't say like, oh, we're not doing this anymore. And so I basically went to go file my Delaware state compliance for the first time this year ourselves, and they just didn't do last year's. And so we had a penalty plus interest that we had to pay. Plus, you know, when we actually, so when I went with Bookmate, we keep our books super clean, super tight. And, you know, even your guy that helped us was, found a few things. He was like, hey, you know, what's wrong with this? Why did you do it this way? Or why? And just like things that were wrong that I didn't really have a good answer. I just trusted our CPA, but it turns out that they weren't really paying attention. They were having our documents signed by someone who wasn't even an officer. I thought it was being signed by our CEO, but it was being signed by just a board member. Just all kinds of things that were incorrect or just not followed up on because they were just being lazy because it's like this old model. But they try, you know, you talk about the office and they try to hover between both worlds, and they all use that. What's that software called? Liskio. I'm sure you're familiar with it.
Yeah.
They use Liskio, but then they use like paper documents for communication. Instead of sending you something saying like, hey, here are your action items, they upload a document that's a PDF that says, here are your action items. And it says the title is action items. And then when you open the PDF, it says no action items. And that's like a document that they send to us. So I was kind of super upset, you know, having learned all this stuff. And then once we moved to Bookmate, it was super smooth. We met for an hour with our bookkeeper. And, you know, they asked questions about what we were doing wrong and how we might clean it up for next year. This is serious, but this isn't serious. You know, it was a really, really awesome experience. And we paid probably a third of what we were paying. So it was a great, great, awesome experience. So not a plug. We actually do use them. And I had an awesome experience because I just hate, and I don't mean to take over your whole interview, but I really, you know, cause you and I, you know, we've talked, your and my business are very similar in the case that we're kind of replacing these old school professional services. And after this issue I had with my old CPA, I texted my wife after I talked to your guy and said, hey, this is basically, we filed with Bookmate in February 15th. And then our old bookkeeper just filed an extension with the IRS like 2 weeks later without talking to us. They just filed it. Not only did they file it without talking to us, they filed it 6 weeks earlier than they actually would have needed to. And so, but then when I asked him what the issue was, he just acted as if there was, might be something wrong. And your guy was like, oh, it's not a big deal. And I texted my wife and I was like, I'm so tired of these old school professional services people that work by the hour, putting like instilling this fear into you to make you think that you need them and you don't. And so based off of my whole rant that I just did, what do you say to that?
Yeah, no, actually, I think there's a really, really important piece that you pick out there. And this is kind of like what our advantages. So, you know, who you're talking about is Alex on our team that you met with. Alex spent 2 years of his career doing bookkeeping for tech startups and small like SMBs, right? So it's like a few tech startups, a few SMBs, right? Up to like, let's say $10 million in revenue. Okay. So he kept the books for a portfolio of those companies. So, you know, I hired him and I was like, you have a very similar experience to the background of our customers filing these smaller corporate returns, these smaller partnership returns, doing books for these types of companies. Because when you have a local CPA, right, they've got to help with a wide variety of issues, like a huge diversity of issues from like, oh, I need to put my personal income from my local small business on my Schedule C to all these like, you know, maybe stock dividends that you have or capital gains to, you know, an overseas business to, you know what I mean? It's like there's an unlimited amount of surface area that they cover. But for us, because we're like, okay, we work with startups and, you know, agencies and e-commerce companies, right, that are up to a certain amount of revenue, maybe let's say like 10 million, right? That means that when you come to us, right, we've served a ton of people that are like that. And we kind of are, I don't want to say we're turning people away that aren't like that, right? Because we'll kind of work with people or see like, hey, maybe is there a fit here or is there not a fit? But because we kind of specialize and attract a certain type of client, we see the same types of things over and over. And we, you know, when you're talking about your books and like, okay, you just assume they're being kept right. Well, we've seen and closed, you know, thousands of books of companies of exactly this type. So we know exactly what we're looking for, right? So when you specialize not in a geography or in helping people in a certain area or within your network that you know, but a certain type of company, you can kind of get into the weeds a little bit more and become an expert in serving that type of company, which allows you to provide better service to your customers because you're not like, oh, I got a new client. I got to research this practice area or I got to find out about this form that they have to file for the first time. You're like, this is very similar to all of my other clients. So I kind of know what they have to do already. That's I think, the advantage.
You can matchmake with people that, you know, if you start getting a lot of certain types of businesses, you can hire someone, like you said, that is specific to that. Cause I mean, with our old CPA, again, I don't know what type of businesses that he provides or services, but you know, Alex, your guy was like, hey, so why aren't you amortizing your research and development? You know, your developers. And I was like, why would I do that? And he goes, cause it's law. And I was like, what? And he sends me this information. I was like, why didn't my CPA know this? Like, he's like, it's not a huge deal. Let's just keep doing it the way we're doing it because like they might actually change the law right now. And then it's kind of a non-issue. And then, you know, moving forward, we can fix it if they don't actually change it. And it's just infuriating that like I put my trust in someone who is a licensed, you know, certified person by the state. And then it's just like, oh, well, it's done anyway. And then if it's an issue, is he going to back, you know, back me up? Or is it just going to be like me hanging out in the wind anyway?
Well,
go ahead.
Yeah. You mind if I make one point off that? Because yeah, that's just a perfect example, right? Where it's like, how many businesses have like research and development expenses? Like if you went down the street and went to a store or you like an insurance broker, right? They're not like researching or developer or anything, developing anything. Now, like for startups, it's very common that you're like developing something, right? But for other types of businesses, it's very uncommon. So when somebody is, you know, a local CPA is just trying to figure it out, there's an unlimited amount of surface area that you can cover as an accountant. There's, you know, millions of things to know. It's impossible to know everything about everything. So, you know, for us, it's just about how do we specialize in a certain type of client? And then we know the things that pertain to those clients. But then maybe, you know, if a, you know, somebody else or with different needs came to us, we'd be kind of in the same position, right? Where it's like, oh, we don't know that practice area. So then we're just as lost as everyone else. But that's where the specialization comes in, I think.
Yeah. Okay. So let's go back and let's talk about your first job, which was at a restaurant, and you were a busboy. So just cleaning up plates and stuff. Tell us why you started working in the first place, and you know how it all started and what you learned from there, and we can go from there.
Yeah, that was an interesting experience. So my dad took me to a local restaurant on my 16th birthday, because in Minnesota you had to be like 16 to work, or maybe you could work before that, but it was like all these special permissions and stuff like that. So he's like, you know, now that you're 16, you're gonna work. And he knew some people in the local community, so he knew the manager of the restaurant, and he kind of had brokered a deal with him ahead of time, unbeknownst to me, right? But I sit down for this interview. He's like, okay, you want to be a busboy? You want to do this and that? I'm like, yeah, you know, of course. I'm ready. I'm ready to work, right? And so I got the job, and I did that for, I think, 5 years. And really, to be honest with you, I really hated it. And I mean, it's just cleaning tables for like 5 hours and running around the restaurant and just cleaning everything up, picking up everybody's food. It's just not enjoyable work. And everybody's always mad at you, right? Cause you're behind and you're the one cleaning up everybody's messes. So like, oh, I gotta, you know, we gotta see more tables. We gotta see more people. We gotta clean all this up. Like there's not a lot of, like benefit
respect
to it, right?
The busboy.
Yeah, there's not. Yeah. And so I'll tell you what about one time, right? When I was maybe 2 years into the job, the urinal in the men's bathroom started overflowing, and they come to me and they're like, hey, like the urinal's overflowing. I'm like, do I look like a plumber? Like, I don't know. Like, I don't know anything about that. And they're like, you're the busboy. Like when something horrible happens that nobody knows how to fix, it's your problem. And so I just walk in there and it's flooding. And I'm like, it was disgusting. I'm like, oh my God. And so I had to sit in there for like an hour and like try to work this out. Right. So it's just really, you have to do whatever the worst thing is that nobody wants to do. That's what you have to do. And I just remember I would just watch the clock over and over and over again and just be like, oh my gosh, 10 minutes have passed, 15 minutes have passed, 20 minutes have passed. And I would just wait until I could go home. And it was a good job. And I generally liked the people that I worked with, but you know, so it wasn't like a terrible experience or anything like that. Or there wasn't anything particularly horrible about it. It was just like, you just have no autonomy, I guess. And you're just kind of ordered around and you just have to do whatever anybody tells you or whatever the worst thing is that has to be done. And it was just really like, I really dreaded going to work, but you know, my dad wanted me to work and he thought it would be a good experience for me. And it was, but not the most fun I've had. At a job. I'll tell you that.
Today I learned that being an entrepreneur is like being a busboy. So, okay. So, you did this for 5 years. You hated this job and you did it for five entire years. Or did you graduate into like, you know, serving?
No, I did it for 5 years.
Five years as a busboy.
Yeah, but not like full time, right? Like I would, I wouldn't do it at all. Like in school during the fall or the winter, because I was involved in activities. But then during the spring, I would work. And then during the summer, I would work. So this is like in high school, right? Because I'm like 16.
Yeah.
And I actually didn't really have ambitions to become a server because I didn't really want to get deeper into it. And the busboys actually at that, like, I don't know how I found such a good opportunity, but the money was really good. Like, it was more money than I could have made doing anything else at that time. Like, I probably made during the summers, I would make like 23, 24 bucks an hour as like a 17-year-old.
You were the guy that had, you were the, also the tradesman plumber.
Exactly. So, you know, it's like, well, I'm 17. How am I going to make $20+ an hour and back, you know, 10 years ago, or more. So it's like at that time, minimum wage is like $7. Like most people are making like $9 an hour. I'm making 20 something. So I couldn't give it up because of that reason, but I really didn't enjoy it. And I didn't really have anything to compare it to. Right. So I was just kind of like, this is what work is. And looking back, so, I realized how much I didn't like it.
Yeah. Yeah. So then you moved to door to door sales for a painting company. So is this you kind of drive around the neighborhood and you see what houses need to be painted and you say, hey, we'll paint your house because it looks kind of ratty? Or is it you literally knock on everybody's house and you're like, hey, are you looking for this?
Yeah, both, mainly the second one. If there's a freshly painted house, maybe you skip it. But what we would do is we would go on like the government websites and we would find the areas and like the neighborhoods where the houses had been built kind of at the perfect time. I honestly don't even remember what it's like. I don't know if it's built in the 70s or something. It was built with like a certain type of wood that would like, or a certain type of material that would like, that the paint would not last as long. So you knew that it was like highly likely that the paint would not be looking good, right, in that neighborhood. So you kind of target the neighborhoods that you
would data driven paint sales.
Exactly. So that's what we did. So then we'd go to those neighborhoods.
You did this while being a busboy. How long did you do this? This, and what was the experience like? That, I mean, that's straight cold sales.
Yeah, I did that for one summer, and it was really terrible. Yeah, it was bad.
On average, were people pretty mean or were they like, just like, no, thank you?
I would say actually not that many people were mean. I would say 1 out of 10 people were like really mean about it. Only 1 or 2 out of 10 would kind of give you the time of day and talk to you. And maybe 2 out of 10 would like at least hear you out, or 3 out of 10, like, you know, they'll listen to your pitch, but then they don't respond, or they're like, no, I don't really want this. But then maybe 1 out of 10 people are a little less than that. Maybe out of 20
right?
people.
Because on one side, you don't want, like, if you're at home, you don't want to be bothered. You just don't want some random person knocking on your door to sell you something. But like, if you need it and it's at the right time, then it's perfect. So like the very few people that you probably sold, or the small minority of people that you sold, probably were like thankful that you knocked on the door at the time. Whereas, you know, it's standard funnels. Like these people were looking for it at exact the right time. And the people at the top were just like, why are you talking to me?
Well, and I was just doing lead gen, right? So what I'm quote unquote selling is free estimates. I'm just like, hey, like we'll come out and we'll quote a job for you for free. And yeah, like 1 out of 20 people would take you up on that. And they'd be like, yeah, I guess I know I need a paint job. Like if you'll come out, give me a free quote, like, I guess, sure, that's fine. We can set up a time. But most people really don't want to be bothered at home, like you said, right? You knock on the door, they open it up, and they say, you know, no, I'm not interested. And they close the door on you. Or not even in a mean way, but just they're like, hey, I don't want this.
The least amount of time that they can give you.
Yeah, which is frankly what I would do, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Totally. I'm not going to. Yeah, so I understood it. But it was really tough. And the thing is, it's not – like the first day is painful because you don't know what it's like, but then it's like the second day, the third day, the fourth day, you're like, I can do this. But it really grates on you over time. When you do it for a month, 2 months, 3 months, I think it actually starts to weigh heavier as you do it more. I don't know. Maybe some people would say that it gets easier, but I did not find that it got easier. I think it actually got like more and more discouraging as I went.
Do you feel that experience has helped you like in modern day with talking to people or reaching out to people with something that you need?
That's a good question. I think that it does in some ways, is a formative experience for me. But at the same time, one thing I learned from that experience and, you know, kind of a couple other experiences, like mainly my first full-time job out of college, is that I'm really an introverted person. So I didn't totally, you know, think about it in those terms at the time. I was just kind of a kid. But, you know, I'm not really energized by talking to people all day, right? Like I can do it. I can sell, I can knock on the doors, I can do it, but it's not for me.
Yeah.
I can do it. I just will not enjoy it. So yeah. I think what I learned from that is just that I'm not going to enjoy it. I can do it. I can grind and get it done if I have to, but you know, obviously nobody's probably really going to enjoy that experience very much, but, I think it toughened me up in some ways and in other ways helped me kind of understand a little bit more about, you know, what I would enjoy doing.
So let's combine the next two summers and speed run this. So you did Thomson Reuters and then AIG. Can you talk about those two experiences?
Yeah. So I interned at two different companies, and very similar experiences, right? Because they're with large corporations. It's like 10,000 person companies. So it's like you come in with your intern recruiting class, you go to orientation, there's like 50 people, and then you kind of get assigned to your manager and they kind of like give you some pet tasks. I think mostly what I found in those internships was at corporations, you know, you don't really have to do that much. You get assigned tasks and then you're like, you do it. And then your manager's like, okay, you did it. And because at these 10,000 person companies, it's like everything's kind of moving a little slower. So, you know, I'm sure there's exceptions, but generally I found them to be, I enjoyed them way more than bussing tables or doing door-to-door sales. But I did feel a certain malaise for sure.
Yeah. I mean, I personally feel like the larger a company gets, the slower it gets and the less efficient it gets. You know, right now, on two polar opposites, you've got Elon bought Twitter, right? And fired what, like 95% of the company. And it's been a year or two, or maybe a year and a half. And the company's still running. I mean, it's not perfect, right? You know, people complain about it being a cesspool and whatever, and Twitter's always been a cesspool, but the fact is, like, it's running and people are using it, and the overhead cost of salaries plus stock options and everything else that makes a company run, or the costs of a company, has been drastically, drastically reduced. And then you've got those core people that actually do all the work. And it's very similar to how you drive by, you see some road work and there's like one guy working and 12 guys watching. And then on the flip side, you've got like Google. At the time of this recording, Google, all I see on my feed right now, on my Twitter feed, is the Google sign-in change, where it's like they moved it from like the one center line aligned box to like now it's like the Google logo's over here and is over here. And they made a big deal about it with the banner where it's like a new look is coming. Try it out. You click it and it's like it looks almost the same. And that's from a company that just has too many people, too much red tape. And then you've got Twitter now, which is just not shipping a lot, but they're also just not spending a lot of money on people that are just there to punch the clock, figuring out when their next happy hour is. Like you want a smaller company that everyone actually cares about the mission and give them enough tasks that make them want to be involved and they like to solve problems. Because if you don't do that and people get discouraged, they're not going to work very hard for you.
Yeah. And let me make one kind of distinction between working in a very big company and a very small company. There's a lot of distinctions, but there's one I can make like very obviously here that kind of illustrates the point that you're talking about and is kind of one of the causes of the slower pace, which is that at a very small company, like let's say, you know, 20, 30 people or less. So a small business, right? The roles are going to bleed together. Right. Some of the sales people are going to do customer service. Some of the customer service people might do sales. There might be somebody that does sales and customer service. Right. You might have product and engineering. You may not have different functions at a startup. You know, one person does kind of all of it, or you may combine roles. Oh, somebody can be the finance manager and also handle the accounting and also do all the HR stuff. Right. But what happens is you get to a bigger and bigger organization where you have 10, 20, 30,000 employees is all of the functions become like hyper siloed. So at my first internship, what I was doing was I was a product research intern. So, you know, you've got like four, like probably more than that, 5 to 10 different brands within Thomson Reuters that all have their own function, right? Like you've got like their big legal products, but then you've got their legal marketing products, and then you've got their news organization. Like you have completely different organizations, right? But then within the tiny organization I was in, there's like product, engineering, marketing, sales, all that stuff, right? I was in product. And then under product, you've got like product management, product leadership, product innovation, product strategy, right? So I was in the product strategy team, and I was doing like one specific task for the product strategy team. How fast can you go when the organization is hyper siloed like that? And it's not a bad thing. It has to be, right? Because you have so many people in so many different functions. But if I move super, 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 super fast, right? That doesn't mean all the other product divisions are going to move just as fast. It doesn't mean that it's going to work with engineering just as well. It's like, you know what I'm saying? It's like, once you go that far down the stack, it's like, you can't really, at a certain point, you just can't move faster because you have to wait for all the other functions. And when it gets that siloed, there's just no way to move that quick.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So then we move to your first full-time job. Tell us about that insurance company.
Yeah. So after graduation, I did sales for a big insurance carrier. Like we would wholesale to like financial advisors, right? So it wasn't like direct selling insurance, but it was more like, you know, a financial advisor would call and say, hey, you know, I'm looking for a potential product for one of my clients. Tell me about your guys' offerings. You know, what kind of products do you have? How do they work, et cetera? So I did that. And that was another really big company. Really, really big company. And, you know, when you're a salesperson at a really, really big company like that, your role is very narrow. You're just selling, and you're just talking about product, and you're not meeting with, I don't even know if I ever met anybody on marketing or I met anybody on product. It was just kind of, you have the thing and you sell it. And if somebody, customer tells you, I don't like the product or I don't think it's a good fit for me, you're like, well, that's all I've got. So I was energized by it for the first couple months. I was like, okay, this is interesting. It was a new challenge. But once you kind of solve the initial challenge, or you're like, okay, I understand the product and how it works now, and I understand who might want it, who might not want it, there's really not much further to go with it than that. Mm-hmm. You just got to keep calling the same people over and over, or talking to the same people over and over, and trying to do the same thing. So it's just very repetitive. And, I started to feel stuck.
Treadmill.
Yeah, no, that's how I felt.
You're moving, but you're not going anywhere.
Right. And you feel like no matter how hard you work or how many people you talk to, you can make a little bit of a difference. But at a company that large, it's hard to, you don't really make a mark on the company. You know, like they could replace you tomorrow. And I'm not saying I wouldn't, you know, it's like their fault or something. If, you know, one of their lower level of their 10,000 employees could be replaced tomorrow, that's like a bad thing. But that's just the reality of the situation. So I just couldn't thrive in that environment.
How long did you work there?
I worked there for almost 2 years, maybe a year and a half.
Okay. Was it like you were there for 2 months and then it was like, I got to get out of here, and it just took another year and 3 months or a couple
so
of
I,
a year and a half or what?
I had to do 3 months of testing and training to even start. Okay. So then I did the job for 2-3 months. So after about 6 months, I was like, you know, I don't know if this is going to be something I can really do, or I don't know if I'm energized by this. And then it took another 6 months before I was like, yeah, I think I'm ready to go. I don't want to do this anymore. And then, you know, the last 6 months, I was just trying to keep my head above water, do what I could do, you know, try as hard as I could, given the constraints, while pursuing other things, which is how I ended up going to my next job.
Okay. So what is the next job? This was a company that you actually started. Yeah.
Yeah. So this is a weird one, but so around the time, so you've got the NBA, right? Let's start there. Professional basketball. And then there's other leagues that the NBA has, like the WNBA for the women's basketball, and the G League, which is for their development league. Right. And so they started a new league called the 2K League, which was for NBA 2K for esports. So one of my friends came to me because we were big 2K fans, and he was like, hey, like they're going to start this 2K League, but nobody's actually going to really keep the stats for it and keep track of the players and how it's all working, right? So he was like, why don't we start an analytics company and a media company to kind of like cover this league and come up with the stats for it. So we did that, and
stop real quick, because that's a lot. So were you working at Alliance at the time?
Yes.
Okay. And so your buddy was just like, hey, there's this thing that's happening, but no one's doing this. Let's start a company and then go pitch them. So is that accurate so far?
Kind of. So what we started is, on the side, we would just keep stats and like publish articles and go on Twitter, because there was like a very small but very active community on Twitter about this. So we would tweet, and then people would be like it, engage. Because, you know, the players, if you say, hey, this player's leading the league in points per game, they're going to like retweet it. They're like, oh, this is promoting me, right? So that's what we were doing on the side, is like, okay, just covering. So you were not,
at first it was just probably more of a hobby.
Yeah.
Or did y'all go in looking at this like it was a business?
We kind of thought it was a business, like a small media company, small business, but we weren't like trying to make millions off of it. We were just like, hey, there are these people who are playing in this league and fans, like a small fan base of the league, and they're going to be interested in stats and media, but there is none. So let's just create it and then see if we can get some,
got it,
you know, some interest.
Okay. So how long did that overlap? Okay. So I'm assuming the entire time that this was going on, this 2K analytics, you were still working full time, or was it a kind of a straddle between?
No, there was no straddle. Okay. I was working full time the whole time. So I would just do both. Yeah. On the weekends, we would do a lot of on Saturdays, we would do the 2K stuff.
I find this interesting because so many businesses, I think, start because people are bored. They don't really like their jobs. Their jobs don't challenge them. There's nothing inherently interesting that they're passionate about in their jobs, but we all have to eat and pay our rent or mortgages and car payments and whatever. And so you need that kind of, people just get that itch where it's like, okay, I've got, my life is great. Things are, maybe it's not great, whatever. I don't know. But like, you know, things are okay. My job's too easy. I'm not enjoying it. I need something else. And so I'm going to give myself more work, but because it's fun, or it's a mission, or it's almost like a puzzle that you're starting over, and you're exploring something, it like this extra work that is not making you any money is almost more interesting than your full-time job. Did you feel that way?
Yeah. And I've always felt that way. I've done a lot of stuff like that in my life. I used to blog, for the NBA. Like when I was in high school, I would just write blogs and stuff like that. And it was totally free. I never really made any money off of it. And, I coached debate for the longest time, high school debate, like when I was in college, and I got paid a little bit, but it was like, basically, you know, I get paid like 500 or $1,000 for like an entire year of coaching. So I would make like no money, but I just really enjoyed it. So I've always done stuff like that where I've taken on extra work or doing side projects or, you know, writing or doing whatever, just because it was interesting to me.
Okay. So how did that evolve? How did 2K Analytics evolve? You guys started doing this for fun. How big did it get? How many followers did you have? What was kind of like, what was the evolution of it?
So here's the kind of the end game. We got up to, after like 6 months, we got up to like 5 or 10,000 followers on Twitter.
Oh, wow.
And we were getting really good engagement. Like we'd get a lot of retweets, a lot of likes, and we had like kind of a brand reputation because the community is very active on Twitter. So it's like almost impossible to not see it on Twitter if you're in that community. So like all the coaches knew who we were, all the organizations kind of knew who we were. We had a number of the coaches reach out to us and ask to work with us and stuff like that. But what ended up happening was, I was living in Minnesota, right? Because that's where I'm from. And Minnesota was going to do an expansion team. They were not involved in the first season, but they were going to be involved in the second season. So we got media passes to go out and cover the finals for the 2K League of the first season. And while we were there, I saw the Timberwolves contingent, and they were like, you know, at the event, they were going to have a team the next year. So I just walked up and introduced myself and gave them some of our material. And I said, hey, if you guys need any help, you should reach out to me. I live like 2 miles from the Timberwolves facility. And they were like, okay. So then they emailed me and they said, hey, would you guys come in, you and your two, you know, co-founders, who are just my friends. And they were like, would you consult with us? So we did that for, I consulted with them for like 2 months. And I would come in on Fridays. I would like take PTO and go work there, or go at night after work and go work there. And then after a couple months, they were like, we're ready to make our full-time hire to kind of run our team, and we want you to do it. So then they kind of recruited me to come work for them. So that's how it happened.
So did 2K Analytics die at that point in time, or did your friends keep that running and then you worked for the Timberwolves?
My friends kept running it for a little while. And then they kind of were interested in other things, or didn't, you know, kind of lost some of the passion, and eventually it, you know, they stopped running it, I think, maybe a year,
was there a
year or two after.
Was there a reason you got chosen out of the group, and was there any kind of, you know, drama that happened because of that?
You know, no, there wasn't any drama. I think I was just the most kind of, I don't know, like in the meetings, you know, I'd kind of, you know, be the most assertive, I guess, and kind of take the lead.
So they were looking for someone autonomous, and you just were kind of the natural fit.
Yeah. I don't know. I don't know, you know, why it was me necessarily, but, I think that it was just kind of a natural thing. Cause you know, we had met with them like, you know, probably 5 to 10 times. So we had known them pretty well. We had all developed kind of personal relationships. And yeah, I don't know. It just worked out.
And so how long did you pursue that for?
I did that for 2 years almost. And so I ended up getting laid off during the pandemic because the NBA completely shut down. Mm. And then when they shut down, they kind of, a lot of the teams did layoffs. So the Timberwolves did a big layoff, and, you know, as a new strategic initiative, right. It's kind of like it's a cost center, not a profit center. Right. So it's kind of like, hey, this is experimental. But you know, in a COVID, when there was no live events, there was a ton of uncertainty. They were like, we're just going to, you know, downsize and focus on the core operations. So I ran that for 2 years and then ended up getting laid off.
And that was almost like 5 years ago now. Like it's 2024, but like that happened in 2020. So
yeah,
it's so weird that it's getting to the point where it's becoming history and not something that we're, you know, still talking about. And I mean, we're talking about it in terms of, you know, how the world shifted, once it happened, but, okay. So anyway, you mentioned that you had some other companies that you were working for the Timberwolves. So like during those 2 years, what other things did you kind of tinker with?
Yeah. So basically the Timberwolves thing, it turned out to, you know, not really be such a good experience. I really didn't enjoy it. And I loved basketball my whole life. And I was like really passionate about basketball. And actually when I was a kid, you know, like when you're 12 years old, people are like, oh, I want to be a professional basketball player, professional baseball player. My dream was always to be an NBA general manager. People would be like, oh, you're in middle school. Like, what do you want to be when you grow up? I'd be like, I want to be an NBA general manager. People are like, that's weird. But that's what I wanted to do. So I was like, oh my gosh, kind of a mini version, right? Like managing the 2K league team, working for an NBA team is kind of the dream. And when that went sideways and didn't really work out, that's what made me kind of realize, you know, if I'm not happy at this company and wasn't happy at my last company, I don't know how I'm going to be happy at any of these companies, to be honest. So I basically set a goal. I was like 24 at the time. And I very vividly remember, and this is like a very pivotal part of my life, where I said, I will start as many businesses as I need to start to be able to live full time off of it for my income by the time I'm 30. So I was 24. I was like, I'll give myself 6 years. I'm going to work on the side while I work full time, and I'll start as many businesses as I need to make a full time income. And I'm committing to that until I'm at least 30. And if I can't do it by 30, I'll reevaluate that. So then I just started starting businesses. So what I would do is I'd get up at like 6 a.m. and I would work on a business for like 2 hours, and then I'd go to work. And then I'd come home for work, and like 2 days a week after work, I would work all night on my own companies. And then on the weekends, I would work on my own companies. I did this for about a year and a half until I got laid out, like about a year until I got laid off. And I started another sports data company that didn't work out. I started a crowdfunding platform for scientists. which was interesting, but that didn't work out. I actually got a few scientists that were willing to be on the platform, but I couldn't find, like, people just weren't that interested in donating. So I was like, oh, okay, that didn't work. And then finally, you know, after a few companies, I would shut them down after about 4 months, because I would kind of test them, see if I could get any demand. And then if I couldn't, I would just shut them down and try something else. So then eventually I started a bookkeeping company. And that's the one that ended up taking off, although we don't do much bookkeeping anymore.
Okay. So how did you, because I'm starting to see more of this, of people just doing kind of this one startup a month. You know, you were giving it several months, which I think is more reasonable. You can't really understand anything truly in a month, unless you're going for virality and you're just like posting on Twitter and people are interested in your journey. And then you find the one thing that the people that are following you like, and that's what kind of hits and then, you know, goes viral. But I do like that strategy of just trying to find, because, you know, after talking to so many entrepreneurs, it kind of is either you have a personal need that you explore because you have this inherent data about it. So you don't even have to do a lot of market research, because it's just something that's been in the back of your head. Your brain has been digesting it the entire time. And, you know, you're like, man, this is what is needed. And then you pursue that. Whereas other people identify a problem and then they go figure out what the problem is and develop the solution and then evolve that into what it needs to be. And it sounds like you were the latter, where you were just trying random things. And I do want to ask you, you know, how you found these ideas and why you pursued them. But it sounds to me like you, based on kind of what I understand and where you're going with this, is you thought about bookkeeping, you did bookkeeping, you handled it, and then that evolved into actually just doing the taxes. And so that initial business that you had a little bit of traction on evolved into what your current business is. So did I get that right, that you were kind of the latter of the two options?
Completely. Yeah, no, I actually am not really a big fan of purpose-driven entrepreneurship. Like if people are like, oh, I have this idea that I have to do, or this business I have to explore, or the world needs this. I mean, and honestly, that's why I have so much respect for Elon and what he's done, because he's had purpose-driven companies and actually made them into huge financial successes. But my thought is that entrepreneurship is so difficult. It is so hard to create a good, profitable company that if you put also a second condition on it, which is it has to be meaningful to you and have like a personal purpose in there, it's like, okay, well, it's basically a 1% chance that you're going to build a super successful business. What's the chance that you're going to build a super successful business that you're also super passionate about that also solves like a personal problem you have? My thought is you can't really smuggle in anything else. If you want it to be a financial success, you want to create a business, there can't be any other constraints. That's just how I think about it.
I mean, that's fair. I think if you have, because like some of the businesses that I'm starting, and you know, I don't take offense to this or anything, but some of the businesses I'm starting are because like I want something and I talk about it with others and they're like, yeah, I want that too. And because I've been thinking about it so much, I feel like I'm already kind of, you know, one foot in. Better Legal was not something that I wanted to start. I fell backwards into it. Accidentally, I was pursuing something else. And this is just the thing that worked. I was doing it as a favor for a friend. And then it kind of just, you know, spiraled into this. But what did you, you know, the research platform, or, you know, the scientist platform, these couple businesses that you started, and then the bookkeeping, what was your mindset? And how did you decide on these problems?
It's a great question. So it kind of got more sophisticated as it went along. The first one, the sports data company that I started first, was just because that's what I'm interested in. Right. So I was like, oh, it's cool. And so I did that, and it didn't really work out. So I, you know, for a lot of reasons, COVID being a big one, right? Because I started before COVID, and then everybody's like, oh, I had a couple customers that are like, well, I want a refund. Everything's canceled because of COVID. So that was a disaster. But then the scientist one was just kind of an idea I had. I was like, this makes sense. Like, this is logical in my head, right? I think that this should work. There should be something like this. And it didn't work. So then after that experience, I was like, okay, I thought that this was a good idea. I thought that this should work, but it didn't work. So, you know, what business is going to work, right? Because that's really all I wanted, is I just wanted a business that would work. So I actually went through about 1,000 ideas. I would look on websites. I would look on, you know, like job boards for who's hiring, right? So which companies are successful, or which companies got invested in, or, you know, any site. Oh, 100 business ideas or 100 businesses you could start. I would just go through. So I went through like over 1,000 ideas, and I actually made a list of criteria where I was like, basically, this is what I can do. Like, these are my skills. This is what I kind of want to do. And I only found like 4 or 5 ideas that fit my criteria exactly. And one of them was a bookkeeping business, because I wanted something that was had recurring revenue, that was a high enough ticket where it wasn't like anybody could sell it, but not so difficult that like you had to like be a lawyer or a doctor in order to do it right. I wanted something that was like somewhat sophisticated, but not too sophisticated, but high ticket with recurring revenue that I could advertise to a broad market, because I didn't know a lot of business owners, right? So I can't use my personal network. I got to like use ads or some generic advertising tool. So it can't be super hyper niche. It needs to be something that like it's kind of applicable, but also as a solo non-technical founder. So I was like, I can't be building a bunch of tech for this. I've got to be able to fulfill the service myself at the start. So I had like 4 or 5 ideas. I'll give you an example of my runner-up idea that I don't think would have worked. But my second idea was doing focus groups, like conducting focus. I was like, I think I could learn how to conduct a focus group. And then I could go to a company and be like, hey, I'll conduct a focus group for you for, you know, $500, $1,000. I don't know what
my entrepreneurial brain is melting right now, because I'm like, how would you even find companies that want focus groups?
Yeah, well, a lot of CPG brands, you know, they're okay, like, I'm trying to like, I'm testing out a new flavor of soda. I need like 10 people to try it and tell me what they think. So I was like, I could do that and charge a decent amount for it. But I was like, I just, you know, I was like, I don't really want to do that. Like, I thought the bookkeeping was a more natural fit for me, but then the company ended up not even being bookkeeping. So, you know, that obviously wasn't even the right idea either.
What was your major in college?
Finance and philosophy.
Okay. So finance kind of does fit in a little bit with it. You know, you don't have a specific degree for like accounting or anything like that, but it's somewhat of a natural fit. Exactly. So how did you find these initial, so once you decided bookkeeping, how did you find your initial customer base?
Mostly through ads. I would run ads and just be like, so it'd be like, but I was advertising it like super cheap. I'd be like $99 a month. I'll do your bookkeeping. And I would get these people through the funnel, and it was just like, you know, people doing it super cheap or wanting it, you know, really inexpensively. So I was dealing with customers that were, you know, when you try to compete on price that hard, right, you're going to attract people who are like really focused on price, right? Because that's what you're offering. But I didn't have anything else to offer. So that's where I started. But then people started telling me that maybe they pay me to do their taxes. They're like, look, actually, you know what? I don't really want this bookkeeping, to be honest with you. I don't really care. I don't think it's enough of a value add. But if you could do my taxes, I have to do that. So I do it. And I was like, I don't do taxes. But then after like the third or fourth person told me that, I was like,
taxes.
I guess I should figure out how to do this, because like nobody's really interested in the bookkeeping, but people keep telling me that they pay me to do their taxes. So maybe I should do that. And so then I figured out how to fulfill some basic tax service, and that's how it got started.
So you're not a CPA, and you know, I'm not a lawyer. I'm better legal and you own a tax company. But I think that kind of just goes to show that, you know, you do need the professionals in certain aspects, right? And we have professionals look at certain parts of our, you know, our stuff. But a lot of what these professionals did, it reminds me a lot of real estate agents. So before the internet, real estate agents were a necessity because they had the data and nobody else did. And so there was this black box. You just didn't know how it worked. And so you would have to go to them to find a house or to sell your house. And they were the gatekeepers. Then the MLS went live. And like, I remember when I bought my first house, I had been using a real estate agent for 6 months, at least, if not close to a year, trying to find a house to buy. And, you know, I gave them all the criteria and I was just basically on an email list that just fed me, you know, listings. There was no research behind it. And I got so frustrated that one day I just sat down and I just combed through the MLS listings and I found the house I bought. But then I had to still pay my agent 3%. And because I was the buyer, I was actually paying the other agent, right? You know, like they say it's 3%, 3%, but the person paying is paying the whole thing, right? And so it's like, what is the point of a real estate agent if the customer is doing, you know, a lot of the heavy lifting, you know, but they're not charging any less. Same with, you know, lawyers and CPAs. There is absolutely a need for them, but you know, there's just so much, you know, like how many times have you talked to an attorney or CPA friend or an accountant friend? I get this most with attorneys, you know, and I know I happen to know, you know, a lot of attorneys. And I say, hey, you know, I have this question, blah, blah, blah. And they're like, oh, I'm not that type of attorney. You need to talk to them. It's like talking to doctors. It's like, I'm not that type of doctor. It's like, there's nobody that just knows things, right? They all send you to someone else, but then they get a referral from the other guy and then they charge you an hourly rate and they have no incentive to be efficient in any way, shape or form. So they just bill you hourly. And it's just the way it's always been, just like real estate agents and same with accountants and CPAs and the like. And so, you know, business people like you or myself getting into these professional services businesses and saying, you know, this hourly rate thing is outrageous. There are absolutely people that need the $300 an hour attorney, the $500, $1,000 an hour attorney, or the equivalent of the CPA. But the small business owner, people that are coming to you or me are not those people, but those people still need to be served. And they need to be served on a level that they can afford and for the level of work that they need for the price, you know, that is fair.
Yeah, it's basically productizing a certain workflow for an attorney or productizing a certain workflow for a CPA, right? Because let's say you had walked into an attorney's office and for you guys, right, you form companies. So let's say you walk into a lawyer's office, you say, hey, I want to form a company in the state of Delaware. First thing they're going to do is they're going to Google how to form a company in the state of Delaware.
Yep.
Because they've probably never done it before. And then they're just going to charge you the same rate that they charge everybody else. But mm-hmm. Like if they've never filed a company in Delaware, they're going to have to learn how to do it. So you're going to have to pay them to learn how to do it, right? But for you guys, you're not saying, oh, come to me with any legal problem you have or like anything, right? If you're getting sued, if you're suing somebody, right? Come to us, we'll do it, right? You're just saying, if you have this very one specific legal problem, and then maybe you expand it out to other services, but the core of it is, if you have this one specific legal problem, we're going to productize this and make it 100 times easier than having to go to an attorney, which is kind of adjacent to what we're doing, which is we're specializing in certain types of tax returns, right? Like we're doing these small businesses, we have a couple different specialties that we do for business tax returns, and we're productizing that. And we're saying, hey, you know, you don't have to go to your local CPA practitioner who can do a bunch of different stuff and could probably learn how to do this, right? We're saying, we just help this one type of customer. We do this one type of thing. If you need this, then come to us. And if you don't need this, then maybe you go to somebody who offers that instead. But when you productize that, it makes it way cheaper and way more efficient because you're just focusing on that one thing.
And so did you, when you were starting, so it sounds like the bookkeeping business, it almost sounds like the bookkeeping business arm of this should have stayed open as a lead generator, where you provide this very inexpensive bookkeeping as a funnel, because that's how you got your first handful of customers. I'm sure you got your cost per acquisition down through your other channels, but like it would be interesting if that was just like, oh, that's how we get leads, is that we offer super cheap bookkeeping services, and people are like, I don't understand the value of this, but I need my taxes done anyway. Like, so what are your channels because like I paid. You know, when I used Bookmate, I paid a single price. So it's not a subscription. But
right.
The assumption is that, you know, I'm going to need to do this again next year, and I'll, you know, you guys did it. And so, you're probably going to do it again next year. How do you acquire a customer, and like, what's your churn like, or, you know, do people stick with you, and how do you like grow the customer, you know? How do you get more money out of them? Do you provide them other services, or do you plan to?
Yeah, that's a great question. A lot of our original traffic came from just ads, but then as it went, we started doing more partnerships. And then now we actually get a lot of organic inbound or referrals or people who just have used our service and they're, you know, somebody comes to them and asks them if they need help and then they refer them to us. So now we're getting a lot of organic as well. We don't really try to expand the customer that much because a lot of the customers that we work with, they just need that one specific thing. And I guess maybe I'll experiment with that in the future. I'm not closing it off, but I don't really have the mindset of right now, at least trying to expand to a lot of other services or like, oh, we sold them a tax return, but how do we, you know, get that average revenue per user up, right? I'm just kind of like, hey, if we build a relationship with this customer, we give them an affordable tax return, they come back to us, they do that same affordable tax return the next year, they're going to be happy with our service and they're going to like us and they're going to trust us. And, you know, maybe that's all we need. If there was a natural extension of that service, you know, maybe I'd offer it, but I haven't found something that I really feel is super adjacent or really feel is a strong value add for our customers. So I feel like our core offering is really good right now, and our customer feedback surveys and everything are really strong. And I don't really want to add another product until I feel like there's something where we can keep that similar level of quality and that similar level of value with a new service. And I haven't found it yet. So I'm just focused on serving our existing users, growing our customer base, and keeping the satisfaction high.
So I found in my business, I don't know if you raised any money or not. We did, you know, we raised about 1.8, and early on, at least my business is very much pay to play. Like it cost a lot of money to get customers. But as the longer we've existed, the less we've had to worry about that because of the same thing that you just talked about. And I'd like to hear your thoughts on this, where, you know, partnerships or people just recommending you because they used you. You know, when we first started, I spent $1,200 on Google Ads and got two customers. And that was what allowed me to kind of continue forward and kind of, you know, play the game. But now we have, I just sent out our very first newsletter today to 61,000 people. You know, we have filed over 20,000 formations now, you know, 7 years later. And so now it's not so much of a like, is this company legit? Or, you know, I don't know. It's like we've existed long enough that it just has kind of, it's the flywheel problem. Like, you know, you can, it feels like you have to lose a lot of money or time or effort and pain and sweat early on. And then it just kind of slowly gets easier. Do you find that?
Yeah, I think that that makes a lot of sense. And that's why, and especially like, I mean, you're in legal services, we're in accounting services. It's such a high trust industry where they're trusting you to do your taxes or, you know, do their books, their financials, right? So, you know, trust is very important. And, but it's also for us, at least, it's a cost center, right? It's a cost center for them. We're not generating them more profits usually by doing their taxes. It's just something that they have to pay to have done. So, and it, you know, there's some tax optimization and stuff like that, but that really comes in once you get to a certain level where you're doing a lot for your business. But so the way I think about it is it's a cost center for their business, but it's super high trust. So if there's what we can do to make it as good of a service as possible and get those referrals is make it as cheap as we can and make it as trustworthy and high, like, and as good of a customer experience as we can, right? And if we do those two things, you know, high trust industries lend themselves to referrals. It's like, hey, do you have an accountant that you trust? Do you have an accountant that you know? Do you have an accountant that gives you a good price? Right? It's a very trust-based industry. So if we provide really good service at a really good price in a high trust industry, I just feel like that's where we can really generate our momentum. So that's what I focus on. It's just keeping the cost as low as we can, while still making money, keeping the service as high as we possibly can. We monitor our customer feedback surveys like crazy, and we survey every single customer as soon as they're done with the service. And then, you know, hoping that that flywheel is going to deliver us more business in the future.
All right. So the company is Bookmate. The website is trybookmate.com. Max, is there anywhere else that people can find you or anything you want to kind of talk about?
Absolutely. I think connect with me on LinkedIn. You know, Max Minsker on LinkedIn. If you have questions about tax or you want to connect, that's the best place to find me for professionally.
All right. Thanks for speaking with us today.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me on, Chad.